Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein presenting Perek Hay of Sefer Melachim Aleph. This is a perek already in which we will see Shlomo HaMelech getting on the road to the task that defines his life the greatest or the best. The pasuk starts us off by pointing out Shlomo haya Moshe v'chol hamamlachot min ha'nahar eretz plishtim v'ad gvul mitzrayim magishim mincha v'ovdim eshlamo ko yimei chayav. Shlomo HaMelech rules over all the kingdoms, we're told, from the river of Plishtim until the border of Egypt, and they all brought him gifts and they served Shlomo all the days of his life. So this idea of Shlomo's rule is an important motif in his life. He had this power, and that was the background for his ability to do many of the things that he did. Interestingly, the Gemara in Sanhedrin on Chaf Amud Beis presents a statement by Reish Lakish, and Reish Lakish suggests that the truth is there was a diminution over his life. While our pasuk says they served him all the days of his life, all the way from the river of the Plishtim until the border of Egypt, Reish Lakish points out that here it says Kol Hamam Lachot. There's a pasuk in Divrei Hayamim that says that Shlomo sat on Kisei Hashem. So Reish Lakish says the first thing was he ruled over the heavens, which suggests that Shlomo had metaphysical power, and power in the world and the universe as a whole. The next pasuk that Reish Lakish quotes is that it says Ki hu radah b'chol eivor ha'nahar meha mitifsach v'ad hazah. He took over the whole plain of the river from Tifsach to Hazah. Then Rav and Shmuel have a debate there, which appears in similar terms elsewhere in Shas, about whether they are on two ends of the world or whether they're right up close next to each other, and that the way they symbolize the expanse of Shlomo's rule is that the same way he was able to rule over two cities right next to each other, he ruled over the whole world. Similarly, elsewhere, just an interesting sort of exegetical comment on when we want to emphasize somebody's power, do we do it by expressing his range, or do we do it by expressing his control over some very manageable thing and saying his control over the whole world was actually similar to that over this very manageable thing. But then Reish Lakish looks in Kohelet and points out that in Kohelet the pasuk says Hayiti Melech al Yisrael, so that suggests that he wasn't king over the rest of the world. And then it says Biyushalayim, suggesting that he was only in Jerusalem. And then going to Shir Hashirim, suggesting that he was only ruler over his bed, he named me Tatosh the Shlomo. And then even beyond that, if you look back in Kohelet, so Reish Lakish says only al maklo. So whether we accept the Yerash or not, it is a suggestion that Shlomo's life was not as unaffected by the vicissitudes of time in terms of his rule over the universe as you might think. There is a story in Chazal, a Midrash in Chazal, that there were 3 years when he got kicked out of Yerushalayim totally, and he wandered in exile and in poverty, and there are psukim that support that perspective. If so, you might have thought that was when he wrote Kohelet. It's not very clear. All of that is not sure, but it's an interesting note on our Pasukir, which seems to emphasize his having rule throughout his life. Pasuk bet, Vahi lechem shalomo liyom echad, shloshim kor solet v'sheshim kor kemach. So his bread for one day, by his, we don't mean his personal, we mean his for his court. The entertaining that he was required to do as part of his job, part of his role, was 30 kor of solid of fine flour and 60 kor of regular flour. And asara bakar b'riim, v'esrim bakar ri'i u'me'atzom. We spoke about this yesterday as well because there was reference to it. 10 healthy cattle, 10 fat oxen, 20 oxen just right out of the pasture, not particularly fattened. Me'atzom 100 sheep, levan me'ayal, utzuv yachmur, barbarim v'abusim. These other kinds of animals, deer, gazelle, fallow deer, geese, whatever it is. These other kinds of animals that he had. Kihu rodeh b'chol eivor ha'nahar mitifsach v'ad hazah. Here too, he is ruling over the whole plain, the whole side of the river, tifsach v'hazah, b'chol malchei eivor ha'nahar, all the kings there as well. V'shalom ha'yalom b'chol avarah b'savei b'ni, and peace all throughout of his kingdom from all sides. So that, just to comment on that food, it's plausible to suggest that that food wasn't excessive, it wasn't a lot, because maybe he had a lot of people that he had to feed. There is, however, a Gemara or Midrash somewhere that I saw, I don't have it in front of me right now, which says that he would have that in each of his wives' houses. every day, because they would never know where it was he was coming to, apparently with his whole entourage. If you take that seriously, then you see the excess, because he eventually has 300 wives, 700 pilakshim, 700 concubines, as we'll see. And the idea that he would replicate the king's court everywhere, just in case he would get there, would be an example of lavishness and extravagance that I've been trying to note, because I think it's relevant to the issues of Shlomo's life. This is the symbol of peace among the Jewish people. Each person under his geffen, under his vine, and under his teina, under his date tree, midan ve'ad be'er-sheva, kol yemei Shlomo. I'm sorry, fig tree, not date tree. I was getting that wrong. Teina is fig tree. From dan to be'er-sheva, all the days of Shlomo. And this implies that there was peace and prosperity, right? Everybody is secure because he has peace all around, and they all live in their own property, benefiting from the work of their hands and growing their own produce, and the sign of what we want and we hope for and what we think of. I find it striking then that the Gemara in Sanhedrin on Daf Kuvav Amud Aleph uses this as one of the examples of Yochanan, uses this as one of the examples of a principle that he says, it has exceptions, you have to go through the whole Gemara, but that when it says Vayeshev, it's going to imply tsar or distress. So his first example is the Jews live in Shittim, sit in Shittim, Vayeshev, they reside in Shittim, and that's when you have the problem with Beno Moav, and they are lured to improper relations with the daughters of Moav, and you have a plague and all that stuff. What does he point to here? Vayeshev Yudav Yisrael Avetach, our Pasuk, and then in Parak Yud Aleph, we see that at the end of Shlomo's life, Hashem is making the Shlomo at Hadad Ha'adomi Mizir HaMelech U'Be'adom. We'll see that when we get there. But that at the end of Shlomo's life, there was an enemy who started to arise and started to cause problems to Shlomo. Interesting about the Gemara, or worth noting about the Gemara, is that the Tanakh explains that the reason for that enemy to have arisen was that Shlomo himself, at the end of his life, failed to maintain his singular fervor for God, and he allowed, at the best, this is what Chazal read, at the best, allowed his wives to sacrifice to other gods. That's a huge flaw. When Rav Yochanan comes here to say that you see the seeds of that in the words of Vayeshev, so that's a striking comment, suggesting something that I've been saying before, that the seeds of Shlomo's downfall, and therefore the Jewish people's downfall, are already found here. And that when we sit comfortable and relaxed and secure, with no problems, there's actually a danger there as well. And this is the danger that's known of Vayishman Yishrun Vayivat, that when we get too comfortable, that's when we're very likely to lose our connection to religion, to lose our fervor in worshiping God, because we feel comfortable, we feel relaxed, we don't have anything to worry about it, to look for. So that seems to be what's going on here as well. The Jews are now comfortable, they have everything they need, everything is good, and yet it's not going to be able to last longer than the rest of Shlomo's reign. Pasuk Vav, Vayi Shlomo 40 elef urvot susim lemerkavo, u'shnemasar elef parashim. Shlomo had 40,000 stalls of horses, and 12,000 horsemen to ride them before him. So this is a pasuk worth noticing, because it's one of the examples of Shlomo HaMelech not listening to mitzvot HaTorah, or it would seem to be, unless you assume that he absolutely needed these for whatever he needed them for, but the Torah had said, we will see later on in Malachim that Shlomo HaMelech had many, many horses, and that indeed those horses were going to lead him eventually to do what the Torah told him not to do, which is to return to Egypt for the purpose of buying horses. So this is an example early on in his reign, in our portrayal of his reign, where we see that his wisdom and his brilliance are perhaps leading him to not take seriously some of the mitzvot of the Torah, that those will have negative impact and negative ramifications as time goes on. Pasuk Zayin v'chilkelu hanitzavim ha'el et ha'melech Shlomo ve'et kol ha'kareim el shulchan ha'melech Shlomo ish chodsho lo yadru davar. So each person who was in charge of a month would have to supply that whole month, and they wouldn't leave anything lacking. V'astarim v'hateved lasusim v'larachash yavo el ha'makom ashi yasham ish kemishpatoa. They would have to send not only all the things that we said till now, but also food for the animals. So barley and straw for the horses, and they would have to bring them to the place where Rav Shlomo happened to be. So if he traveled, the Netziv's job was to make sure the supplies joined him there. So their responsibility not only were to raise it, but they had a implementation challenge. They had to make sure that they had the supply lines taken care of. So now we have a repetition or a reminder that Hashem has given this great wisdom to Shlomo. The wisdom was given to him originally for the purpose of judging the people appropriately and properly. And this is just his great wisdom. He had greater wisdom and understanding than anybody around them, all the people of the East, all of the wise people of Egypt. He was smarter than anybody. So he's smarter than the thing that you understand, Eitan, Ha'ezrachi, and Heman, and Kalkol. So these are people who have, some of them have Tehillim named after them as well. It could be they were generally bright people, or it could be cloaked references to others, like Avraham Yitzchak and Yaakov, to people like that, depending on how midrashic you want to get. But the point is that his wisdom was not only a Jewish thing, but only Jews recognized it, knew it. He was known everywhere as being extremely bright, extremely brilliant. Then he put that brilliance to various uses. Pasuk Yud Bet tells us, right there, Shloshet Alafim Mashal Vahishiro Chamisha Va'elef, which means 3,000 Mashal, or parables, or proverbs, or expressions of wisdom, and 1,005 poems. But it says Chamisha Va'elef. So, what exactly this means, there are various interpretations of that. Some read it as that he said 3,000 mashal on each piece of Torah there was. Others think of this as being three sections of Mishlei, where it says Mishlei Shlomo, and that there would be 1,000 somehow. How you would cut the 1,000 is a complicated question, but there would be 1,000 in each of those things. And then Shiro Chamisha Ve'elef is also a question of how you interpret it. Does it mean that there were five books that he wrote, the three of Mishlei and Kohelet, and Shir HaShirim, that would be five, or does it mean some other version of those numbers in terms of what he did, in terms of what he produced, right? So Rashi reads it the way I just said it, and the Radak does not read it so literally. Hold on. The Radak thinks that we don't have his Mishalim, we also don't have all of his songs, because lots of books have been lost to the Jewish people, and this is just an expression of his wisdom that he had, but that even Shlomo HaMelech's books were lost over the course of time, and we don't have them completely. So whichever way you take it, that we're expressing the great wisdom of Shlomo HaMelech, and Pasuk Yud Gimel, Vayedaber La'itzim, Mila Erez, Asher Belevanon, Yvan Ha'ezov, Asher Yotze Bakir, Vayedaber La'meimah, Vela'ov, Vela'rimes, Vela Nagim. So literally we take it as that he could speak to the trees, perhaps, but Alaitzik would also take it as about the trees. Rashi seems to take it more that way. Rashi seems to say that it means that he understood what his tree needs and what his tree was useful for, and so too with the animals. He knew how to heal them, and he knew how to grow them, and he knew how to produce them in the most positive way possible. And therefore, his wisdom is usable in terms of making the universe, or Earth at least, in terms of all of nature, being able to get the maximal use out of nature that was possible and appropriate. Pasuk Yidal tells us that from all around people came to hear Shlomo's wisdom because it was so great, to learn from him. Who had heard of his wisdom. This would suggest that his wisdom wasn't only in areas that Jews could appreciate, but it was in areas really that all could appreciate, and that's why he had that kind of impact, that kind of power. So if Shlomo HaMelech had just been as we would call it, a Baki Bashas, if he showed him the Chronim, he knew and understood, and he was in Torah, and in Torah in the narrow sense of Torah as Mitzvot Hashem, he would not have had the impact on his surroundings that he apparently did. It was they came to see wisdom in general, what they could appreciate his wisdom, and he had that as well. Chiram the king of Tzor sends his servants to Shlomo, because he had heard that he had become king instead of his father. Because Chiram had always liked David. Chirav had a relationship with David of love and of friendship. And so Chirav hears that Shlomo is the next king, so he sends messengers. What does he say to him? Just say hello. So Shlomo sends back. Vayishlach Shlomo Chirav lemor atayadat et David avi ki lo yachol livnot bayit l'shem Hashem elokav mibnei hamilchama asher sivavuhu ad treit Hashemotam tachat kapot maglav. Shlomo sends back and says, you know, my father David was very interested in building a permanent structure to house God's presence, a permanent structure to build a Beit HaMikdash, what we call a Beit HaMikdash. He expresses it as a bayit, in the name of God, not to house God, but in the name of God. And so Shlomo says that he couldn't do it because of the war that surrounded him, and he couldn't do it until he was finished with all those wars. The problem with this is that the story of Devarim even suggests that David wanted to build a house. I mean, the story in Shmuel as well. He wanted to build a house, and God tells him not to, because he's not allowed to. So it is connected to war. You know how you read that. The simplest reading of the Pesukim suggested it was because David had a lot of blood on his hands. Chazal read it as he had so much blood on his hands, they were like korbanot, that therefore any house that David HaMelech built would be indestructible, and therefore Hashem didn't want it built because the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash in some strands of Chazal is actually a favor to us. It allows Hashem to punish us greatly without having to destroy us, because Hashem is able to, as it were, express his anger on the sticks and stones of the Beit HaMikdash rather than on the Jewish people. So Shlomo doesn't say that, though. So Radak thinks that Shlomo was just trying to cover over his father's honor, not to admit that David had been banned by God from doing this, had been banned by God from building a Beit HaMikdash. In any case, he says, "Dovyata, Hinei Hashem Elokai li misaviv, ein satan v'ein pekeras." So Shlomo says, but now I'm okay. I have no enemies. Here, Satan is an enemy or a distraction. Vein pegara, there's nothing bothering me. Vehini omer li livnot bayit l'shem Hashem, and I alokai. I am planning on building a house in the name of God, my God. Kasher dibir Hashem al David avile more. As Hashem, in fact, had told my father David, saying, "Bincha asher etein taknecha al kisaka yivdeh habayit lishmi." That's what Hashem had promised David, that the son who comes after him would build a house. And now that's my plan. I intend to build a house. So now Shlomo comes to the favor he wants to ask for from Chirab. Let them cut down cedars from Lebanon. These are strong, good trees for building. And I will send my servants with you. With your servants, and I can pay you for the use of your servants. Because you need to know that we don't have the skill of wood chopping nearly as good. We don't know how to do it as well as the people of Sidon know how to do it. And therefore, I'm turning to you and I'm looking for assistance in this matter. So we're going to talk about, or the first thing we'll talk about, what the servants of Shlomo that he sends up actually do, because it seems like he doesn't want them chopping wood, and there are other things that are also hard, backbreaking labor that are a different class of slave. So it seems like when Shlomo Melech sends his servants, his slaves, they are only required to do fairly white-collar versions of the work of the Beit HaMikdash, and not the hardest versions of it. So in Pasuk of Aleph, though, Kiran reacts the Shlomo's Melech with joy. He was very happy. Baruch Hashem, Hayom Asher Natan LeDavid Ben Chacham Ala Amar Rav Hazeh. He says, thank God who gave the Jews, who gave David's people such a smart king. So the nature of Shlomo's intelligence here in Hiram's version is not clear. Maybe he just heard in general, but that's not what he says here. He says he's happy hearing Shlomo's words. So it suggests that Hiram either knew from David, or just from the sense that Shlomo gave, in which Shlomo makes it clear, that he feels responsible to continue his father's ways, Chiram realizes what a blessing that is. Very often, people have children who, even if they continue in their father's business or profession or whatever it is, feel the need to wipe away that legacy and take a completely different path. And here is Shlomo undertaking a huge task for the very purpose of completing unfinished work of David's life. That might be, to my mind, anyway, what Chiram was celebrating. I heard what you said, the message you said. I'm going to give you, do for you, all that you are asking for, whatever you want. Different kinds of trees, cedars, cypress, whatever kind of trees you need. Avadai yerdu min halevanon yama. They'll bring, I'll have my guys, my servants, bring it down from Levanon. They'll chop the trees and bring them down to the sea. Vani asimem dovrot bayam ad hamakom eshet tishlach elai. And I will put them in rafts, and I'll tie them together and sort of log roll them down the river to where you tell me. Vani patztim esham vatatisa. And there they can be broken up, and then you can find a way to transport them from wherever, whatever port we send them to, and bring them to Jerusalem. So, if you do, what you need to do for me is feed them, give me food for my household, so that I can get this done. So, in other words, the deal is being made, and Chiram is telling Shlomo what he needs, Shlomo is agreeing, and this is what happens in Chafdalet. Vahi Chiram, everything he wanted in terms of the wood. He gave him 20,000 core of wheat, a huge amount, obviously, food for his household. And good beaten oil, 20 core to sort of mix it all together. So there was a price to it. Chiram is doing him a favor, but Shlomo is paying a handsome price for it as well. But again, as we pointed out previous days, in times of plenty, so it can be a favor, even while you're paying huge amounts of money. Everybody's getting rich. Everybody's happy. Everybody's getting what they need. Pasuk Chaf Vav. V'Hashem natan chokhma l'shlomo kashre diber lo. V'yishalom ben chiram v'et shlomo. V'yichretu v'yit shneha. So Hashem gives Shlomo wisdom. Part of that wisdom, at least from the juxtaposition of the pasuk, at least from the way the pasuk reads, is that he understands the need and the importance of making peace with Chiram, because he gets the wisdom, and then there's peace between Chiram and Shlomo, and they make a brit, they make a covenant together. So the issue of the covenant together bothers the Tosfot in Yevamot on Chav Gimel Amud Aleph, because we have a prohibition in the Torah of Lo Tichron Lehem Brit Lo Tichonem, that you're not allowed to make a pact with them. So the them is the question here. Who is the them in that pasuk? And you can't compliment them either. So one way would have been to read it narrowly as the Shiva Abamid. It's only with the Shiva Abamid. So that's the last version that Tosfos has. That's the last answer that Tosfos comes up with. Tosfos really assumes, at the beginning at least, that the prohibition is against anybody making such a pact with anybody who's an idol worshipper. This is just a complicating issue for those who would like to think about a foreign policy for a nation run upon Jewish law. The question being, to what extent do we need to impose our beliefs on others? If Tosfot is assuming that we can't make a brit with idol worshippers, that would mean that anybody who qualifies as an idol worshipper by Jewish law would be somebody we couldn't make a brit with. So that affects, for example, if there was such a thing today as a Catholic nation, and if it were true that we followed the opinion that Catholicism's belief in the Trinity qualifies as a Vodazara, it creates many, many problems. These are problems that have been dealt with many times before. Rabbi Dr. David Berger has an Orthodox Forum article on it. In one of the volumes, how we relate to non-Jews, I think it is. But it's an interesting question. Tosfot is assuming that if Chiram was an Ovid of Vodazara, we'd have a problem. Now, interestingly, the Rambam does say that if we conquer certain people, we're required to force them to abandon Avodazara. But it's not clear that if we haven't conquered them, well, they may make a brit with them, even though they're not, even though they're worshiping idols. It may be that because they're not in our control, in our physical lands, we wouldn't have to. That's interesting in terms of the question we asked about Shlomo earlier. We said collected tribute from nations all around him that they served him, and they sent him gifts and presents. So again, was that a kab? Was that a pact? Was that a brit? Was Shlomo allowed to accept it even though they were still idol worshipping? Not so clear. Tosfos also suggests that perhaps Hiram was different. Perhaps Hiram had agreed not to worship idols, and he was a ger toshav. He was somebody who had rejected idol worship and was keeping the seven mitzvot b'nei Noach, the seven Noahite commandments to the best of his ability. And then Tosfos also suggests the possibility that the only pact that's prohibited with Lo Tikrot Lehem Brit would be a pact l'shem avodat kochavim, if it's a pact to agree to worship idols. That is extremely lenient. You know, we've gone all the way from extremely severe, you cannot make a pact, even if you haven't conquered them, with any nation of idol worshippers. The most lenient piece would be, you can make a pact with anybody, as long as it does not contain any kind of specific agreement to worship idols, or, if you want to be a little more stringent, to allow them to worship idols. As long as that's not an issue that's mentioned in the pact, so maybe that would be all right. So that whole perspective becomes a question, not only for our understanding of Melachim, but a question for our understanding of how we're supposed to relate to those non-Jews around us who may worship what qualifies as idols in our book. So there, even today, are such people, and it could easily become a problem and an issue worth considering. So here's a place to begin that process. Pasuk of Zayin, Vayala Melech Shlomo Basim Kol Yisrael. He raises a levy or tax, Vayamash Lushim Elavish. And the tax was 30,000 people. The problem with the tax of 30,000 people is that it would seem to be that those people are taxed and all the rest are not taxed. So Rashi thinks it means he raised the money to pay the 30,000 people. And those people, when they were taxed, they were sort of not just taken against their will. They got paid for it and supported by this tax. Radak seems to think, though, it was a rotating thing. It went through all the tribes. And each tribe had to give 10,000 people on a rotating basis, rotatingly, or whatever the right word would be for that. And that's what the mas was. And he sends them in Pasuk Chavchem, Vayishlachem Levanona, Aser Alfim Bachodesh, Kalifot Chodesh, Yiyu Balabonon, Shnayim Chodeshim Beveitom, Adinu Rai Balimas. There were a rotating 30,000, 10,000 each month. This 30,000 people would spend 2 months at home and 1 month at Levanon. This suggests, by the way, this is just that it was the same 10,000 over and over. So it seems like the same 10,000 people, which, if you're going to think the mass, the tax, was the people themselves, so not money, as the Radak tries to, you'd have to explain why these people got unlucky enough to always be the mass for their respective tribes. In any case, they spend a month away and 2 months at home. This is part of an interesting debate in the Gemara Ketubot. The Gemara is talking about the responsibilities of a husband towards his wife, and one of the responsibilities is to have an ordinary or a mutually satisfactory conjugal relationship. And in that context, if she foregoes conjugal relations, so the Gemara assumes that it only be she allows him to travel. If they were living together, the Gemara didn't assume or didn't understand that they would just voluntarily not have conjugal relations. But let's say he's traveling for business. So how much can he travel? Can he take a 5-year trip? Leave her behind. So the Gemara seems to think that whatever she's willing to agree to, she's willing to agree to. But the Gemara then says, "Urcha de milta kama." But what is the appropriate amount, or what is an amount that's reasonable, and that we don't suspect he's put undue pressure on her to get her to agree to? So Rav thinks it's one chodesh, 1 month al home, and 1 month away. You have to be home at least 50% of the time. And Rav Yochanan thinks that no, you got to be home 2/3 of the time. And he, Rav Yochanan, used our pasuk. It was a month away, 2 months at home. So they have a discussion there. Rav says that was only because there were other people who could do the Binyan Beit HaMikdash. And Rav Yochanan says the only reason why you're allowed to be away that much was because you're going to have extreme profit. And that's why you can be away as much as 50% of the time. So the Gemara seems to be saying that it's really not so reasonable to be away from home more than 50% of the time, for sure. Nobody says that. And probably somewhere between 50% and 2/3 of the time is what was seen as appropriate, barring extraordinary circumstances. Pasuk Chavtet, Vayhi Lishlomo 70,000 Nosei Sabal, 80,000 Kutsev Bahara. There's another 150,000 people who do the really hard labor. They're stonecutters, they're porters, they're doing backbreaking stuff. The Gemara's tradition is these were people who were desperate to convert. We've spoken before about the fact that we didn't really accept converts, but since they were desperate to convert, they converted. But then they got to do this work because Shlomo preferred not to enslave the Jewish people themselves. Then he had sub-representatives to oversee it, another 3,300 people. Harodim ba'am osim ha-melacha, they oversaw the labor to make sure the work was done properly, appropriately, and at the right speed. Vayetzav ha-melech, so he commanded vayasiu avanim gidolot, avanim yekarot, v'yaseh nabayet avnei gazit. They bring down stones, great stones, expensive stones, and they're going to lay the foundations with these great stones. And these stones are called avnei gazit. The Gemara's tradition was that Shlomo builds the Beit HaMikdash with something called the Shamir, a special worm that knew how to cut stone and cut it straight and flat, because the tradition was that we preferred not to use knives, because the Beit HaMikdash is supposed to be a Beit of Shalom, and knives and metal, like the Pasuk says about the Mizbeach, knives and metal are symbols of war, and therefore that we would want to do it. Vayefsalu bonei Shlomo, uvonei Chiram, v'hagivlim, v'yachinu ha'etim, v'avanim levnot ha'bayit, and Shlomo's builders and Chiram's builders and the Givlim, another group of people, they all together prepare the wood and the stones to build the house. So in the next Prakim, we're going to see Shlomo build the Beit HaMikdash and build his own bayit, and we're talking about Shlomo as builder. Have a great day.